Begin and cry for nothing that might have been. Oh, I'd rather have nothing at all. Don't put your lips so close to my cheek. Don't smile, then I'll be unrecall. The kiss in your eyes, the touch of your hand makes me weep. Nothing at all. And if I fell under the spell of your call, I would be caught in the undertone. So you see, I gotta say no, no, no.
Born in Flint and raised in Detroit, that's the one and only Betty Carter with All or Nothing at All, performed live at the Hamburg Jazz Festival in 1993. Dave Holland on bass. Betty Carter's style was distinctive and ever-evolving. Always in the moment, she combined her superb vocal skills and interpretation of lyrics with the mastery and precision of an instrumentalist. She died in 1998 at the age of 69, but by then had left a lot of evidence of her work. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. And first up, we're talking about Donald Trump speaking American ugly with a French accent. Donald Trump, of course, you know, is the front runner among Republican candidates in the 2016 presidential race. And he has an admirer in France, Jean-Marie Le Pen, founder of the far-right, trenchantly racist National Front Party. And so we are going to discuss the parallels here. And our guest is a very dear friend, Gilbert Mercier, or Gilbert Mercier, editor-in-chief of the News Junkie Post. That's newsjunkiepost.com. And thanks, Gilbert, for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Utrice, for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
I'm thankful that you are able to help us understand this phenomenon. As you know, Donald Trump, with inexplicably, and perhaps explicably too, because we kind of know the genesis and what sustains his popularity here in the United States. But what did you think when Jean-Marie Le Pen found it admirable that Donald Trump is actually running and saw a kind of a collaborative effort here? How did tell us about Jean-Marie Le Pen and why you think he would find Donald Trump to be a really kindred spirit?
Well, this is Jean-Marie Le Pen has endorsed officially Donald Trump. Even so, he's not the leader of the Front National anymore. His daughter took over. He's still the founding member, and he's sort of work in the same nebulous that the other far right in Europe. At the end of February, he endorsed on Twitter Donald Trump and stated, "If I were American, I would vote Donald Trump." And is Trump has been falsely called by a lot of his supporters the international leader of the populist revolt against the elite. But this is really a joke, just like anything that has to do with Donald Trump and to some extent Jean-Marie Le Pen, because both Donald Trump and Jean-Marie Le Pen are very much part of the establishment, very much part of the elite, and they sort of cross populism, if you wish, appeal to blue collar, middle aged, racist, white male. It's very, very specific, but that works a wonder in both France and the U.S. Economically, however, they are very much privileged people. They just pretend to be ordinary people. You know, it's really a mockery. Trump is very much like you stated in your opening statement. He's very much a caricature of what can be called fairly or unfairly the ugly American. You know, he's crude, he's rude, he's racist and sexist, and he's vulgar, and that makes him a very attractive leading man for what I called in my recently published book, the lowest common denominator empire, because it's a show, and Donald Trump is a showman. You know, it is sort of like in the scripted reality show that is U.S. politics, that has become U.S. politics, the sort of politics as spectacle. Donald Trump serves in many ways as a scarecrow, as a sort of a decoy to get really ultimately Hillary Clinton elected. And it will work beautifully to get Hillary Clinton, the African-American vote, the Latino vote, and of course the woman vote.
What is it about Jean-Marie Le Pen? How did he come to such a high profile in France? And what do you see as the parallel with Donald Trump coming to such a high profile at this time in the United States?
Well, Jean-Marie Le Pen rose, he was very much involved in murky time of the Algerian war in favor of the general that wanted to overthrow the French government and didn't want peace with Algeria, which General de Gaulle eventually imposed in 1962. He was also a paratrooper in Indochina doing the nasty war that France had in Indochina in the 50s. And he's sort of the heir of what was called in France at the turn of the century Action Française. And Action Française has, you know, kind of inspired in many ways. They were anti-Semitic, anti-foreigner. They were sort of one of the writers for that group, Maurras, was really a source of inspiration for Adolf Hitler, okay, for the rise of the Nazi in Germany, and Jean-Marie Le Pen has stated before that a lot of the stories about World War II were fabricated, that really the Holocaust was not that bad, that he's really a neo-Nazi. That's what he is at heart. But the anti-immigration stand of Trump echoes the main political platform of the European far right, not only in France, but also in the Netherlands. You know, the rise of Trump, as a matter of fact, is really a concern specifically in Germany, and it's been expressed very recently, as a matter of fact, on March 6th, by Vice Chancellor Sigmar Gabriel, who stated that just like Marine Le Pen, the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, who is now the head of the Front National, and Geert Wilder in the Netherlands, Trump was not only, and I'm quoting him, a threat for peace and social cohesion, but also a threat to economic development. Okay? And that brought, in a parallel fashion, a very interesting statement from Angela Merkel, who paid tribute to Hillary Clinton in a few statements recently, in a way that is a de facto endorsement of the Democrat frontrunner. So it's what the political establishment in Europe want, obviously, is Hillary Clinton to be elected. But there's a great deal of fascination for U.S. politics in France and in Europe in general, and everybody kind of it's very closely follow, and it's also very entertaining, you know. It is entertaining because it's kind of showbiz, and that's why Trump is sort of perfect in that context.
Well, one would have thought that by now, since Trump has disavowed any association with the Ku Klux Klan and David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, I like the titles these folks have, that similarly he would have said, well, thanks, Jean-Marie, for your endorsement, but no thanks. But he hasn't.
Oh, yeah, of course. But that has to do with the, you see, the problem with the KKK and an endorsement from the KKK. It's a loaded gun in the U.S. You just cannot have that. You know, an endorsement from Jean-Marie Le Pen doesn't have at all, even so it's kind of the same connotation, really, because those people, their agenda is a racist agenda, an exclusion agenda. It doesn't have the same connotation here in the U.S. You know, but the thing is, you know, Donald Trump's function, you know, in my opinion, it's just like the one in many ways of Bernie Sanders. It's kind of to give the illusion that there is a real choice, a real democratic process in the U.S. But the thing is, the puppet master of the Orwellian Empire, just to make a reference to my book, I've already determined that Hillary Clinton would make a fine president. And there is an interview, Henry Kissinger was interviewed on NPR on the show of Scott Simon about a year ago. And when asked about the upcoming election, Henry Kissinger said, well, even so, I'm a Republican, and I'm not going to support, you know, a Democrat. Yes, my good friend Hillary Clinton would make a fine president. So you have it from Henry Kissinger himself, you know. So it's the thing is, it's kind of a farce, you know. And as far as the Clinton, you know, it is kind of incredible that despite what I would call the misdeeds of the Clinton, Bill and Hillary in Haiti, which they have been more or less running like plantation owners since the earthquake, Hillary is going to get most of the black vote, you know, and of course. Thanks also to Trump, who treasures statement on the wall and kicking out 11, I believe it was 11 million of Mexican, she will get the Hispanic vote as well. And of course, Trump's success will get Hillary the woman's vote. You know?
Jean-Marie Le Pen's National Front Party was said to have played a pivotal role in creating an extremely hostile and racist attitude and atmosphere in France, clearly targeting immigrants, especially from Africa, targeting Muslims, and talking about class warfare and in terms of maintaining racial purity and cultural purity and the like. And this movement blossomed, this invective took on a life of its own, to the point where just recently we saw that the counter attacks began to manifest themselves as acts of terrorism. The attack on Charlie Hebdo and so forth. Even liberals, people who describe themselves as liberals and left of center people, were adopting the same racist, xenophobic attitudes. Do you see Trump as the Le Pen of the United States in that sense, with his anti-immigrant talk, his racial invective, claim it's just plain hate speech, accelerating a mood in the United States similar to what you experienced in France?
Absolutely. You know, it's all about, as I said 5 minutes ago or so, it's all about creating an atmosphere of exclusion, an atmosphere of fear, an atmosphere of, white only, an atmosphere of, kicking foreigners out, an atmosphere of, in the case of Le Pen, it's la France aux Français. You know, in the case of Donald Trump, it's, of course, America's number one. And it's about being a white, not only a white, but being a white male. You know, it is just this sort of like, so of course it's going to echo with rednecks in the South. It's going to echo in many ways because they are gullible, and they are completely gullible because they don't realize that Trump is not at all like them. Trump is a New Yorker. Trump is, of course, a billionaire, and he has absolutely nothing to do with them, you know. But ultimately, the joke is with the only American people. In a way, in a Orwellian construct, it is perfectly fitting for a clown to aspire of becoming the emperor.
All right. Well, take us through this theory, this Orwellian theory, that it takes a clown, somebody who appears to be clowning, to bring about this Orwellian empire. How do you see it unfolding?
Well, it's very simple. Again, Hillary Clinton will win. And it will be like it's been for 30 years since the first election of Ronald Reagan. It will be business as usual. It will be the same people running the show. You know, I mean, the way I see the two Obama terms, I see the two Obama terms as sort of an extension as the Clinton terms. So the Clinton, in a sense, the White House and the sort of corridors of powers and where decisions are really made, they've been around for so many years that it is just unbelievable. So the same people will stay in charge. You know, this Donald Trump things, and people are not seeing that in Europe, but they barely see it here. To me, it serves as an entertainment purpose, and it serves as also selling the fact that, yes, there is a choice. Yes, you know, the democracy here is alive and well, and I don't think it is. I mean, I don't think there's any true alternative to, you know, to what the establishment want, and to the candidate of the establishment, which is Hillary Clinton.
Do you see in France, for example, I'm saying France because we're talking about Jean-Marie Le Pen, was there or is there still a formidable opposition to this kind of thinking, this ideology? And do you see any evidence that there is in formation a resistance to Donald Trump's ideology?
Oh yes, there is, very much so. In the people like Jean-Luc Mélenchon, le Front de Gauche, very much so. But it's the thing is, you know, the people like François Hollande, the current French president, there's really very, very little difference between François Hollande and somebody like Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. You know, very, very little difference. All those people are establishment people. They are, you know, sort of running things for the interest of mega corporation, and that's what's going to happen. The there is stuff in the talk, in the rhetoric of both Trump and Le Pen that sound appealing because that is the twist. The twist is this. It's the revolt against the elite, but there's no revolt. And that's what's so Orwellian about it, because there's absolutely no revolt. It's sort of people from the elite pretending to be against the elite.
and that is the Orwellian plan, you see.
Exactly.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Gilbert Messier, editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post, newsjunkiepost.com. You can access his writings and his analyses there. And he's the author of the Orwellian, Empire. Oh, I forgot the last.
The Orwellian Empire, which is I don't want to make your listener feel like I'm plugging shamelessly my book. The Orwellian Empire is actually available on Amazon for the sort of ironic price of $19.84, which of course makes reference to 1984.
Thank you so much for being with us today. I really
appreciate
it for bringing this to our attention.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. We'll take this break and come back and talk about misery as a political backdrop. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. At the urging of Hillary Clinton, Sunday night's CNN-hosted Democratic so-called debate with fellow contender Bernie Sanders was held in the beleaguered city of Flint, Michigan, which remains mired in a public health disaster as the city concedes that it is responsible for exposing tens of thousands of residents to lead poisoning and bacterial infections from its water system. Abayomi Azikiwe, a very familiar voice here on Lead Stories, a Detroit organizer for the Workers World Party and editor-in-chief of Pan-African Newswire, is with us. He says that Flint served as a convenient backdrop, but were substantive issues affecting it and its residents? Did we hear anything about that much? Thanks, Abayomi, for being with us today.
No, thank you for having me.
Well, it's in your backyard that the Democrats came trolling, using misery, it seems, as a political backdrop. What came of that so-called debate, and how are people reacting to it?
It was a very interesting series of developments. Both the Clinton campaign as well as the Bernie Sanders campaign have been in Flint now for several weeks. It was almost inevitable that they would have a debate in Flint. Flint has been a national as well as international news story since late last year when it could no longer be covered up by the governor's office, although the people in Flint knew, people around Michigan knew, people around the country knew that tens of thousands of people had been poisoned by lead and copper in the drinking water system. However, the debate took place, and it appeared to be more of a personality contest between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Now that the debate is over, tomorrow is the primary election. Some people have already voted absentee. The question is how much attention is going to be paid to Flint by both the Sanders and the Clinton campaign after tomorrow. That is the major issue that many people in Flint are wondering about right now. There's been very limited efforts taken in regard to rebuilding the infrastructure in Flint. There has been a minor start that was jumped off by the mayor, Dr. Weaver, and we'll see how much actual support the state of Michigan is going to put in, and also the federal government under President Obama, because there's still many, many months before a new administration is going to take power in Washington, D.C., and the people in Flint are suffering immensely. I was up there a week ago for this huge concert that was held at Whiting Auditorium. A lot of hip-hop artists, R&B artists, comedians, were there. They were raising money. They were making some very profound political statements. But all of this has to translate into something tangible for the people in Flint. This is what they need. They need a new water system. They're going to need massive medical remedial assistance. The school system is going to have to be revamped. And that is still an open question, how all of these issues are going to be addressed.
Well, I thought you were the perfect person to talk with us today, because Flint is the Detroit of the moment. We also have so many other predominantly African-American cities in Michigan that are similarly situated, not only in terms of the lack of city or tax levied services, but having to do with the inordinate amount of suffering that the residents of these cities are experiencing, because they have this one thing in common. They are all under emergency management. The governor basically has usurped their democratic rights to self-govern. Could you talk about why there was this missed opportunity yesterday in this debate? It was not addressed, this question about emergency management of cities, and becoming so pervasive more and more. We have it spreading now even into Chicago's school system and threatening other predominantly African-American communities across the country. Could you talk about that a bit?
Well, yes. As I've mentioned on this program on numerous occasions, the whole political system inside the United States, the notion of local control, of electoral democracy, of public hearings, of public debates over vital issues are being set aside at the aegis of the powers that be, the bankers, the corporations and their agents within the state structures. And that is what is taking place now inside the United States. Now, even though in Detroit they removed the emergency manager from the municipal structures of the government, even though it remains in the public schools, the situation is the same in Highland Park and Inkster, as well as Benton Harbor. There still is a state finance review board that in actuality represents emergency management. It's a very concealed committee. They hold meetings, but they're really not publicized. And they have to agree to every decision that the city council and the mayor makes in these various municipalities. But that issue should have been front and center, the question of governance. And it crosses partisan political lines because, first of all, if you remember, in Benton Harbor, it was a Democratic governor, Jennifer Granholm, who imposed emergency management over Benton Harbor. In regard to Detroit Public Schools, it was also Jennifer Granholm who imposed an emergency manager there in 2009. Under the Snyder administration, he strengthened and enhanced the emergency management system after a referendum that voted it down overwhelmingly on a statewide basis in 2012. So the question of democratic practice and democratic culture and governance is very, very important. And the Clintons, in particular, since they have been involved in national politics, they've been in the White House. Hillary Clinton was also Secretary of State under the first administration of Barack Obama. They, too, are responsible for this undemocratic process. If you recall, during the 1990s, we had the ominous crime bill that was signed. There was the further deregulation of the financial industry. There was the North American Free Trade Agreement, which did come up last night in the debates, which was supported by and engineered through Congress by the former Clinton administration. So Hillary Clinton is a supporter of this same form of financial deregulation, of so-called globalization, which is just modern-day imperialism under a new name. So they have a lot to conceal in that regard. But at the same time, it's unfortunate that some political figures, for example, even the mayor of Flint, gave an endorsement to Hillary Clinton earlier on, several weeks ago. And I don't live in Flint, but I feel that was totally unnecessary because, first of all, it's the wrong signal to the citizens of Flint that somehow, if Hillary Clinton is elected to the White House later on this year, that the problems will be addressed seriously in Flint. And there's no guarantee that that will happen, because we can see how the deregulation of the financial industry impacted cities like Detroit, like Flint, like Highland Park, like Inkster, like Benton Harbor, with the massive foreclosures, with the transfer of public assets and public wealth to private interests. These are the issues that need to be discussed in these debates, but they are not being discussed neither by the Republicans or the Democrats. And, of course, the Republicans were here last week, and they drew a lot of protests and a lot of outrage. But for some reason, the Democrats, to a certain extent, get a pass on these issues. And I think it has really been to the detriment of not only the African-American people, but other national minorities, as well as working class and even middle class people in general.
Well, this is the point I keep emphasizing. The cities that you just ticked off that are under emergency management, that are predominantly African-American, whose essentially whose democratic processes have been stripped away. They are no longer in charge of running things. These tend to be local governments that are largely democratic.
Yes.
We go back now to this question. Here you have very clear evidence that the Democratic Party is responsible. It's on watch. It's on their watch that all of these things are occurring. And we have not seen up until now, even now, we are not seeing either a recognition of that or some degree of concern that, gee, well, if only for public relations purposes, I mean, we got to do something as a party instead of just talking about what people will get when I'm elected. How about showing something that we have done as a party to secure your rights now and years ago? They can't show that. In Detroit, when you have been covering the forced bankruptcy of the city of Detroit, we heard last night in the debate the talk about, you know, how the Obama administration bailed out Detroit and Hillary Clinton was just ebullient in her self-praise for actually approving of a bailout that actually did black people and the people of the city of Detroit in, because in fact it was a losing proposition. And in effect, the bailout really positioned Fiat, a foreign-owned car company, to be better prepared to buy its way into the market and at the same time to get the jobs overseas. We just recently came through a very tough round of negotiations by the United Auto Workers Union where they had to fight like tooth and nail for a cost of living adjustment. These things are not being connected at all, so that ideologically you could say with a certain confidence there really seems to be very little, if any, difference between what the Democrats are saying, what the Democratic Socialist is saying, and what the Republicans are saying in terms of what is it that, where are the people benefiting? There's a lot of talk, but the actions seem to contradict all of the talking that is going on.
Yes. The president, Barack Obama, was elected in 2008. He took office in 2009. That happened to be the same year that the Democratic governor of Michigan imposed emergency management on the Detroit public school systems. And the system has not improved. It's gotten worse over the last nearly 7 years. And there was no effort by the Obama administration through the Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, to even do an investigation as to whether or not the voting rights of the majority African-American citizenry and residents of the city of Detroit had been violated. No mention of it whatsoever. We can fast forward to 2013 and 2014 during the imposition of emergency management. President Obama was in the White House. Hillary Clinton, of course, had left the State Department. However, she's still championing his administration and its efforts around the country. They did not assist at all. The strongly Democratic electorate, composed largely of African Americans in the city of Detroit or Highland Park or Inkster or Benton Harbor, when their voting rights were stripped away from them, when a Republican governor who was a multimillionaire essentially nullified the results of an election in 2012 and imposed legislation against the will of the majority of the people, not only in Detroit and these other impacted cities, but the electorate as a whole in the state of Michigan. The Justice Department did not intervene. The Civil Rights Division did not intervene. And what was interesting about the bankruptcy in Detroit is that the U.S. government actually submitted a brief in the federal court saying that the entire bankruptcy process was constitutional. This was the most outrageous aspect of this whole scenario. And then, of course, when Hillary Clinton talks about the bailout of the auto industry in 2009, she does not talk about the tens of thousands of jobs that were lost across the country, the hundreds upon hundreds of dealerships, car dealerships that were closed down, people who lost their businesses, the ones who worked in those businesses, for example, mechanics, clerical workers, and others who had union jobs who were put out in the streets as well. And it was Obama as well who continued the massive bailout of the financial institutions inside the United States while Hillary Clinton sat in his cabinet as Secretary of State. And yet at the same time, there was no moratorium on foreclosures and evictions for the millions upon millions of people who were thrown out of their homes and apartments across the United States, and particularly here in the state of Michigan. There was no moratorium on plant closings during this whole bailout process. There hasn't been any moratorium on school closings, where in the city of Detroit, over 200 schools have been shut down since 2009. So it's a very selective memory, and the bailout of Wall Street has done nothing except worsen the conditions of most African Americans here in the United States. Wages have been driven down. People have not recuperated at all since the 2007 through 2010 Great Recession, as it is called, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression of the 1930s and 1940s. So here we are again.
Is it fair to say, Abayomi, that while all the suffering is going on over all these years, that practically none of the people running for office ever, and including, by the way, I put, including the president, ever came to Detroit to deal with this situation, or
no,
to Flint to deal with that situation, or to Belle Isle or any place else under emergency management? Is it fair to say they just wrote these cities off?
In essence, they have, because the president did come to Detroit during the Detroit Auto Show.
He went to
January.
The auto show.
He came in order to trumpet what he describes as a successful bailout of the auto industry. Interestingly enough, when the presidential limousine was parked outside of Cobo Conference Center, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of teachers protesting against the deplorable conditions in existence in the Detroit public school system while his limousine was parked outside. So this was the contradiction of his championing of the bailout of the auto industry. And he only in passing referred to Flint in the third person, saying that if he had a child in Flint, he would be beside himself if they were subjected to drinking lead contaminated water. If he had a child. Well, he doesn't have a child in school in Flint, but so he never said how he felt as president, how he felt as a public official in regard to what's going on in Flint. So it's complete avoidance. It's a complete word game to deflect attention away from the role and responsibility of the federal government in this whole process. It wasn't just the state of Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality that ignored the constant pleas of the people in Flint. It was also the Environmental Protection Agency, which is a wing of the United States government, which also ignored those pleas. And it was only one person within the EPA that actually spoke up, and they were reprimanded and told not to have anything to do with the people in Flint. So the culpability for this crime rests both with the state of Michigan as well as with the federal government.
Could you, because this is what you do. You are a community person. You're active in the community. You and many others still are part of the resistance left in Detroit and places like Flint and Belle Isle and others. Could you describe for people, because somehow people don't seem to connect to the actual, what life is actually like in Detroit right now, or in Flint right now. How are people living there? What is the state of affairs in these cities?
Well, what is the most irritating and the most outrageous are the constant misrepresentations and outright lies from the corporate media and from the officials that the city is, if not on the way back, already totally made whole again as a result of the emergency management, the bankruptcy, the imposition of the first white mayor in 40 years in the city, Mike Dugan. So this is the most egregious of all. Now, when you look at the concrete conditions, all you have to do is look up the statistics on unemployment, on infant mortality, on the conditions in the Detroit public schools where students are going to classes in which there's very little heat or too much heat, where there is leaking roofs, where you have a situation with mushrooms and mold in classrooms, overcrowded classrooms. It's all there for the general public to view. So this is the actual conditions under which people will are living. And when I was in Flint last week for this concert, they had students there from schools who were saying that they could not drink water out of the school water fountains, and that at one school, administrators were actually selling the students bottles of water, even though millions of bottles of water have been donated purportedly for the benefit of the people of Flint, who cannot drink water out of the tap, even though they have to pay for it. So these are some of the outrageous things that are being done in both Flint as well as in Detroit. In Flint, people are still getting water bills for water they cannot drink, they cannot bathe in, they cannot cook in. That is also very, very, very outrageous. In Detroit, you have a situation where people are being put out of their homes because they cannot pay overvalued property tax assessments. Coming up at the end of this month, approximately 50,000 more households are facing the potential of property tax foreclosure. So more and more people are being forced out of the city, and even resources that were allocated by the federal government to assist people in staying in their homes by paying off mortgages, by paying their property taxes, a lot of those funds are being utilized for demolition purposes with no bid contracts, where people are making a lot of money, and there's really no checks and balances. They claim that the federal government is looking into it, but how do we really know? These things are being done in secret, and there's really no checks and balances whatsoever. So this just gives you a brief glimpse of what is going on in the cities in the state of Michigan.
Could you talk about what the resistance is? Who is fighting? What are they? Are they gaining ground?
Well, it's fractured. The resistance is fractured, and the assaults are daily, and they're constant. For example, just last week it was announced that retired judge Stephen Rhodes was being appointed as the new, what they call, transition manager over the Detroit Public Schools. Here's another assault,
Just explain a little something. Stephen Rhodes is the federal judge that oversaw the forced bankruptcy of Detroit.
Right before he retired. And now he's ostensibly retired. He's making a lot of money as a consultant in Puerto Rico. And now he's being paid, I believe, over $18,000 a month for purportedly managing the transition of the Detroit Public Schools from emergency management back to some form of local control. This is totally unacceptable. What right and what expertise does he have to do anything involving public education in the city of Detroit? So it's just another way of letting the people in Detroit know that they have no standing, that that the government completely disregards their interests and their desires. They claim that later, I believe in October, they're going to appoint either a Detroit Education Commission. That's still up in the air due to debates in Lansing, the state capital, or perhaps another emergency manager. But even among the Republicans who control both the state legislature and the state Senate, they have been incapable of agreeing themselves on how to deal with the Detroit public school system. The system is deeply in debt, and the heavy indebtedness is a direct result of emergency management, the waste, the corruption that is going on, the lack of expertise, where you have so-called business people running the education systems, which they know nothing about. So it's going to remain to be seen what actually transpires in this whole process. They claim that the district may run out of money next month, which would mean they'd have to shut down, that teachers would have to be laid off, students would have to be sent home until some, quote, solution, unquote, is found. But any solution that these same interests are bound to come up with is just a continuation of the same process of underdevelopment, of destabilization, and just super and gross exploitation.
I think it is important to emphasize here that we're not just talking about, you know, a dozen people. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who are caught in this whirlpool, this black hole that has sucked them in, and they can't get out. And yet, there's all this supposed firepower. I mean, the most senior member of the congressional delegation comes from Detroit, John Conyers. You have all of this supposed power within the Democratic ranks in these cities. What's happening? Why is there this disconnect? The president is a Democrat. The Congressional Black Caucus is mostly, almost all Democrats. You have these powerful Democrats at the federal level, and you have powerful Democrats at the state level. So the Democratic Party has been an utter and complete failure, and worse, it is basically predatory. It is eating its own in Detroit and in other cities that are currently under emergency management that have been left defenseless. Was Conyers anywhere to be seen with this Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders coming to town?
I have not heard anything from Congressman Conyers about the debates, and perhaps he was there, I'm not sure, last evening. They, of course, were going at each other on a personal level, that is, Sanders and Clinton. And the point of raising, you know, all these developments that have been occurring over the last 3 to 4 years is to illustrate how the people of the state of Michigan have been neglected through this whole period. And now, when there's an election coming up in November, when there are primary elections that are taking place tomorrow, all of a sudden, the African-American people, the working people of the state of Michigan, are essential. They are front and center in this whole process. If you were here, you would see on the television stations where Hillary Clinton is surrounded by hundreds upon hundreds of African-American women and churchgoers and workers, as if, you know, she is the champion of this constituency within the city of Detroit, Flint, and the state of Michigan as a whole. And Bernie Sanders has held a number of rallies here in this area. He has a lot of supporters here as well. So these are some of the things that are going on, and it just goes to show the hypocrisy of the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party, because even for the whites, who they are trying to create even more animosity towards people of color and immigrants and Muslims, they too have suffered as a result of this crisis, and Trump is playing into this whole discontent from the right, and Sanders is of course utilizing the discontent from the left and even from the center, against the center of the Republican Party and against the center of the Democratic Party. And developments last week outside the Fox Theater indicate clearly that the country is becoming more and more polarized, more divided. People were screaming outside the area where the debate was going to take place, calling Donald Trump a Klansman, a Nazi. Even the unionists who are out there, most of them did not have campaign signs from any candidate. There were some Bernie Sanders signs. I didn't see any signs for Hillary Clinton. And a couple of people had signs for Governor Kasich of Ohio, who has been putting a lot of money in the state of Michigan as well. But until there's an election, we get ignored. Nobody's really concerned about the conditions that are going on in these majority African-American cities. But now, of course, we are important. Our grieving mothers are important. Our school children are important. Our churches are important. Our workers are important up until tomorrow. And then, of course, this will continue somewhat until November. But if history tells us and teaches us anything, we know that beyond November, unless there's a rebellion, unless there's a general strike, unless there's outright upheaval across the country, we'll continue to be ignored in this whole political process.
Well, you kind of presaged where I'm going next, and hopefully you'll be available to tell us how, as an organizer, we can begin to fashion a sensible response, a workable response to the utter and complete betrayal of the people by their political systems and their political leaders, and why it is important, really, at this time, to strike a blow for one's community's interests. And this is the time to do it. No other time but now. Thank you so much, Abayomi. Quite an
Thank
education you.
You
give us every time you talk to us. Thanks so much for being with us today.
All right.
And that brings us to the end of our program. I hope it was useful. We see how things are connected. You think this Donald Trump phenomenon is just in the United States? Well, it isn't. He's got fellow travelers all over the place. And when I tell you that there is a realignment occurring, believe it. This is what it is. This is what it looks like. Thank you so much for joining me today. Coming up next, the Global Research News Hour. You want to stay tuned for that. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about this program and whether you've learned anything valuable today. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.